may please the court, Mark Stern for the government, the appellant in this case. The issue before the court is one of statutory interpretation, the meaning of the term agency records under the Freedom of Information Act, as it appears in this case. This court is recognized in its decisions in Bureau of National Affairs and Paisley. Going back to the early 80s, there is neither a definition nor very helpful legislative history to guide the court's application of that term. But the court has, over the years, on several occasions, had occasion to apply it, and believe that the most relevant instances are those involving a FOIA agency and Congress.
And from precisely which term are you talking about?
The term agency records.
Okay.
Agency is not in dispute in this case. That can also be interesting, but not here. But we do have agency records, and from this court's decisions and factors that it's announced sort of generally in United v. Stand, and more specifically in cases that preceded it, such as Goland and Paisley, sort of take away a few factors that we think are of particular relevance here. And first of them would be the understanding of both the White House and the Secret Service with regard to who controls these documents. The agency and the White House could not have been clearer on this point. It was a memorandum in 2006 under the Bush administration that sought to memorialize best practices and a common understanding.
Memo occur?
That was 2006, Your Honor.
What was the state of the litigation in the Crewe case at the time that memorandum went out?
I can't remember whether it predated Crewe. I will say that what happened, my recollection is this: there began that the sort of current series of cases began with a request from the Washington Post, and up until that time, although there had been some isolated requests for sort of small numbers of documents, the Washington Post sort of threw into relief this particular problem. And we, in Washington Post, we responded with declarations from the White House, or I think it might have been the Vice President's office in that case, and the Secret Service about the joint understanding. And as a result of the fact, and clearly the agreement was entered into because litigation had started to make it sort of imperative to establish an understanding beyond the understanding that was being set out in declarations. But it was the same understanding. It was not sort of invariance. And that is the joint understanding, and it spells out the purpose of the records, the way in which they are used and returned to the White House. So we've got control. The sole function of the Secret Service in this particular capacity and the sole function of these records is to allow people in the White House to see visitors. That is the only function that's here. The record is absolutely clear on that. It's also relevant, we think, that unlike cases like Ryan versus Department of Justice, which noted that in some areas the president, in fact, in most areas, the president has a lot of discretion in his ability to structure his operations, that is not the case here. The president and the vice president are bound by a statute to accept Secret Service protection. They do so, and it's imperative that they do so.
So I thought that was a slightly different argument than the one you started with. So the way you started your argument here, this fits in a sort of a standard set of questions about control of the records and stuff. I thought your overarching argument is that the Freedom of Information Act clearly does not cover the president's calendars. That is, if somebody just said, I want the president's calendars, you would say, under Kissinger and under Meyer and under Armstrong, well, sorry, that's not covered. That's the office of the president, and Congress did not intend the Freedom of Information Act to get those records. And now Congress has, at the same time, required the president to accept Secret Service protection, but it couldn't have meant to eliminate the exclusion for the president's calendars by forcing the president to accept Secret Service, and that's it. Isn't that the overriding argument you're making?
That's the heart of our argument. We think that the court needs...
That wouldn't depend very much on who controls the records at all. That would be, this would be a sui generis or a unique case. It wouldn't be an attempt. It wouldn't open you to the question, well, couldn't you just issue a memorandum of understanding for every record in the Department of Justice?
You're
right. Rather, it's specifically about the fact that the president's calendars, court has held in the past, because they are documents of the president, are not covered by FOIA, and you can't get an end run around that rule by requiring the president to have Secret Service protection.
No, that is, we think that this is a unique case. We don't think that our sort of brothers on the other side suggest that a ruling for the government in this case would effectively permit the president to sort of like run rogue around FOIA and, you know, sort of pull in all sorts of documents from agencies and assert control.
If we were to hold, as your nuanced argument before Judge Garland's question seemed to suggest, that by the creation of a memorandum of understanding, you can take documents that otherwise might be construed to be agency records and convert them into presidential office records, then that would be what we would be looking at, wouldn't it?
Yes, but we are not... I want to make clear, we do not think that that is true. Okay. We disclaim any assertion of that nature.
The memorandum of understanding is, as the label suggests, only a reflection of the relationship as it had been brought about by the various facts, including the president's need for Secret Service protection and the inaccessibility of presidential documents.
Exactly, Your Honor. That's exactly right. And that's sort of what I was trying to sort of get at by just looking at these things together. We do think that this is unique, but we think it's very important. It's a very sort of narrow case. We do not think it is capable of expansion, but we also think it's extremely important.
Can I ask you about what happened to the burden argument? I am a little confused. So it's about the burden argument. I'm a little confused. So below you argued that they're asking for every single, not just as in the previous Crewe case, documents relating to seven or eight people. They're basically asking for here from now on for every record of entry into every request by the White House or by anybody in the White House to allow a visitor to visit, correct? And you said that as I understood the argument, was that would require reviewing every such one using the White House's limited staff of people who otherwise would be advising the president to review every record, and that was too burdensome, right?
To put it, the answer is...
Speak a little louder.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. There is a part of... going forward, from I believe it's September of 2009, the president adopted a voluntary disclosure policy under which the vast majority of these records are released on a regular basis.
So does your burden argument only apply up to September then?
There is a particular argument, yes, that would apply to the, and really because Crewe, we understand the request to apply essentially from the time that it's made, and the time that the request is made is more or less coincident with the adoption of the voluntary disclosure policy. So in fact, just as a practical matter, I think virtually the entire relevant time period, it would fall within the period prior to the adoption of the voluntary disclosure.
The FOIA you rely on doesn't depend on the burden at all.
No, it absolutely does not, Your Honor, and that's why I had not mentioned it.
There are two different I just want to focus on, I understand that the argument we started with has nothing to do with burden, but you did make a separate argument below. I guess it's sort of an exemption five, but it's a more broad argument, which the courts upheld in the past, that a very broad FOIA request that would be extremely burdensome to the agency just don't have to comply to. You can make them narrow the request.
Right.
And now let me just see if I understand the facts. The Freedom of Information Act request was made at a time which you didn't have this new policy.
I believe that it was made just about September 1st of 2009, and more or less just about the same time that the voluntary disclosure policy
was adopted. It couldn't have been seeking records for the new policy. It could only have been seeking records, since given the time it was made, for the old policy.
Right.
Is that right?
That's our understanding.
Is that your understanding of the litigation here? That is, are you can a party sue for production of documents that they never made a Freedom of Information Act request for because it was before the time, it was after the time?
Our understanding would be that it had to be up to the time that the request was made, that you're making a request for documents in existence, that you're not sort of kind of putting a flag on documents.
So if that's the case, let me be frank. I'm wondering whether this isn't a sort of an arranged appeal here. That is, first you argue that there's an enormous burden and you can't possibly pick out a single document. If that's the case, we don't have jurisdiction yet because that issue has not been decided by the district court. The district court said you only have to produce the documents that would not be a burden. And I don't mean this in an impolite way when I say
that. I understand, Your Honor.
But all of a sudden, we have a affidavit that says, aha, we have found at least one document that it would be no burden to produce. Now, how is that consistent with your other argument? How was that one document found?
Your Honor, we did that. I mean, we did that because the last time, and we don't think that either this or previous appeal were arranged, certainly not arranged by us.
What I mean is, in our previous panel, which at least two of the three of us were on.
And your court held there was no appellate jurisdiction.
Yes, because you hadn't exhausted your arguments about your exemptions.
Well also, that's right, but in one of the, I forget which Judicial Watch case it was, from around 2004, 2006, dealing with the same kind of problem about jurisdiction, what we did was to identify a document, just sort of as a sample. Look, we know that this really is an injunctive order.
Well, I understand.
Subject
so
to appeal, and that was the reason.
That's what I mean by arranged. But so now my question is, how did you find this document? So if you just randomly picked it, that would not be consistent with your argument about burden, because you couldn't randomly pick every document.
Your Honor, there are two points. First of all, it wasn't random. It was the White House Secret Service looked for a document and there is no doubt that many documents are sort of not sort of within the scope of sort of at least traditionally understood privileges. And our burden argument is not merely a sort of, well, there were a lot of records. The problem is that this is the Secret Service isn't in a position to make any determinations about what privileges would apply if we had to go to that step. That's got to be at the White House. Now, what the declaration explains is that because the White House is staffed largely by detailees, many of the people who were sort of put in
I read it, and I understand your argument.
Right.
I'm trying to figure out, have you abandoned below now? So imagine we say these are agency documents, and you go back below. Have you abandoned your burden argument? Because you've been able to produce a document, apparently without burden, because the court only ordered you to produce documents that you could produce
Your Honor,
without burden.
We do think that there is a difference between identifying one document that is plainly not privileged and asking the White House to go through all the documents and then evaluating them for privilege and then asserting privilege with the requisite specificity to withstand what is usually, in my experience, fairly exacting review.
Right, but so if you were to go back, your first argument would still be that there's no way for us to look at individual documents because eventually we'll have to look at a million of them. And then the district court probably will say that's not good enough, and then we would get up here on the burden argument, not just on the agency record argument.
Your Honor, we presented all the information that this court has about the nature of what's required was presented to the district court. The district court did not say this is a excessively broad request. What the district court sort of told us to do was to go forward, and we do not think that at this point, coming to the district court and saying, remember all the stuff you looked at before, we take it that based on that you didn't want us to do anything.
This doesn't, I understand you think you're going to lose. The only question is when does it get to us?
Well, I think it's here now, Your Honor.
But the question is whether it's here because you've arranged a jurisdictional, are you abandoning your burden argument
below? Your Honor,
below?
If we need to abandon the burden argument in order to assure this court of its jurisdiction.
You better be careful by saying yes here, because if you lose, then you've abandoned the argument. It seems like an enormous thing to give up.
Your Honor, I don't want to give up anything. that's like my role as an attorney is not to give things up. What I want to make clear is that the problem that we face going forward, it's not just like you can sort of take out like all the sort of like categories of people who come to the White House in parties and so forth.
So that's what I was wondering. So as this would be consistent with your burden argument that you just picked out, the Christmas party, and that's where this record came from, not a part of the president's private meetings, but you just picked out somebody who entered for a party.
Yes.
Is this within that kind of category?
What we've done is certainly consistent with our burden argument. What I want to make clear, though, is that this burden argument is going to be there at the end of the day, and this case will be back up here. We'd be very happy to never have to appeal in these cases.
If we don't reverse.
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Just to get your argument clear. The burden argument will be back if we don't reverse the injunction.
If you're here.
Your Honor, eventually this issue, I believe, is going to come to this court. And
I'm sorry, what is going to come?
The issue, the status of these records, the Secret Service.
That's the issue
records.
Apparently the before issue. Us now.
That's right.
Right.
And
we've decided it, right?
If the court decides the status of the records, that's what we are asking the court to do. And I was trying to respond to Judge Garland on the issue of the burden point, which we made in response to sort of the district court's view that the agency record, that these are in fact not agency records, and that the government should go through them and determine whether privilege can be asserted with respect to the different documents. And we think that that's wrong in principle under In re Cheney, and we also do think that it's extremely burdensome. If there are no more questions.
Not sure Cheney's on point.
Well, Cheney is on point for the proposition that the when it comes to the president and the vice president, requiring
this didn't come to the president or vice president here.
Cheney
was actual process issued to the vice president, wasn't it?
It's not clear that the vice president would have had to personally do anything. It went to the National Energy Policy Development Group,
Energy, not health, energy.
Yeah, and this court had said that that denied mandamus on the ground that it was a discovery request, and it said that we should go forward and assert sort of privileges as relevant, and the Supreme Court said that the denial of mandamus had sort of assumed, failed to take into account the special considerations that obtained because it was the vice president's office in that case that would be having to assert the privileges. And certainly we do think that that Congress, after all, carved out the sort of executive or lots of parts of the executive office of the president because it was keenly aware of separation of powers concerns.
They carved it out, or they just didn't carve it in.
It didn't carve it in, and after this court's decision in Soucy, the court sort of Congress codified that decision. So it was never in there to begin with.
The legislative history after Soucy says we intend to adopt Soucy's position, and thereby we do not intend to cover that specific.
That's right. Of the president. That's right.
And the Supreme Court adopted that in Kissinger.
That's right.
Okay, unless my colleagues have further questions, we've taken you far beyond your allotted time, and we'll thank you, counsel. Go ahead. We've got people at the wrong tables today, it seems to me. Like, I'm used to you being appellee, Mr. Stern. And
not at all, Your Honor.
It's nice to see Mr. Stern lose one. He's usually at that table. So excuse me for looking for you at the wrong table, counsel.
Not today, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. James Peterson on behalf of Appellee Judicial Watch, Inc. I must admit, after listening to the government's oral argument, I'm not entirely sure what they want this court to rule on this morning. But what is before this court is, are these records that we've requested under FOIA agency records? This court, as you all well know, has a very well-established test that to address this question set forth by the Supreme Court and then the four-factor test enunciated by this court. Application of that test.
You don't think our well-established treatment of documents that come from a FOIA-exempt government agency have any application? Or government
he means
entity,
Congress.
Put it more broadly.
In this case, Your Honor, we're not talking about a FOIA-exempt agency. We're talking about the Secret Service.
No, I'm talking about the presidency. We have a relationship between two government entities, the Office of the President, FOIA-exempt, right?
The Office of the President itself within narrow confines,
okay.
Yes, correct.
And the Secret Service, right?
We
have documents in which both entities have an interest, right?
They have an interest.
And why is the analogy to documents in which Congress had an interest not applicable here?
Well, because the United We Stand case, which the government, in the cases before that, which the government relies, is distinctly different.
And it is. One thing that struck me is that the court was very concerned about the bind that Congress would be in, a bind which Congress, of course, could solve by amending FOIA, which the president cannot do on his own.
Well, that is correct, and it is also true that what was important to the court in that case was that you were talking at that point about two co-equal branches of government. A FOIA request was sent there. The FOIA request in that case involved confidential congressional matters in a narrow context. In this case, we're talking about an agency which is indisputable.
You shift from one side of the interaction to the other. The parallel to Congress is the Office of the President, right?
Only in a broad sense, they are different in this case. The distinction is important because what it is doing is it's bringing in another branch of government which is not subject to FOIA, and that's what made it different. The United We Stand case, the Congress is obviously not subject to FOIA.
Right.
In the United We Stand.
By its choice.
by its choice. And by trying to bring in FOIA in this context, the court in United We Stand recognized that that was a problematic situation because it jeopardized the role that Congress had carved out for itself. It made very clear that the oversight role of Congress would potentially be jeopardized.
Why? So this is a somewhat disingenuous question, but there is no oversight clause in the Constitution. The courts have accepted and Congress has asserted an oversight role. There is a take care clause in the Constitution, which requires the president to supervise the agencies. Why is the president's ability to supervise the agencies less important than Congress's authority to have oversight? In a way, I wonder why there isn't more of a separation of powers problem when you use a congressional statute to prevent the president from doing his work as compared to when you use a congressional statute that might disclose Congress's own work, which, as Judge Williams says, Congress could always amend. If Congress thinks there's a problem with respect to its own documents, it could always amend FOIA to say any document originated in Congress is protected. So the president's office is a fortiori from the congressional offices rather than less worthy of protection.
Well, again, there are a couple of points there. First, we're not talking about just the president or his most immediate staff. We're talking about all visitors to the White House complex, larger universe.
I agree with that. So that's two different arguments.
Okay.
Here, right?
I
think this argument plays no role at all with respect to the executive office of the president or any of the other parts of the White House that are not FOIA exempt. I totally agree with you. So just for purpose of this argument, focus only on the office of the president as an example.
Well, this is, of course, not an unusual circumstance in FOIA in the sense that many documents that are requested under FOIA of agencies have gone to the White House, have come through the White House at some point, and FOIA has a process for dealing with that. It's the Exemption 5 is there to assert, if necessary, the presidential communications privilege. The process is familiar and routine. The agencies know how to deal with it when matters might involve something that's confidential and relating to the White House. It's not an unusual circumstance in FOIA for that to be dealt with. Now, that's where it starts to veer off from the congressional circumstance, United We Stand. The most significant difference, I think, is that we're dealing, in one hand here, with an agency which is routinely subject to FOIA requests. There's a process for dealing with it. Congress built in a way of protecting the prerogatives of the executive. There's no doubt there may be, at some point, some information in records that is subject to exemption. The district court below clearly said that. United We Stand, as that court clearly tried to say it was different, a different circumstance, dealt with a specific request that was highly confidential and was a separate part of government. It put on a collision course these two co-equal branches of government. What we're talking about here is the routine case. This is a FOIA request to an agency. Some, certainly not all, as you note, some of that information may involve...
Just going back to United We Stand, that starts as a routine request to an agency, doesn't it?
It does, but the...
So that's not a difference.
No, but the information that was subject to that request involved a request from Congress as to a confidential request from Congress. So that's how the court distinguished that out and noted that it only in that unique circumstance.
Well, how the court distinguished that out lost me. The court in United We Stand?
In United We Stand, yes.
Distinguished that out from what?
From the ordinary agency record FOIA case. That was an exception. That court was fairly clear that...
And well, the exception was?
Because it involved a request that originated with from Congress evolving a to the IRS for a confidential request. That was how the court noted that this was an unusual circumstance and that the records should not be subject to FOIA. That was the unique circumstance in that case, and the court's pretty clear that it's to be the exception to the rule because it involved distinctly and importantly the separate co-equal branch of government.
But it wasn't even the document of that co-equal branch. It was a document that the co-equal branch requested the IRS to actually produce.
Right.
So under any routine theory, it would have been a document of the IRS because they produced it.
Well, I'm not suggesting.
Not defending it.
Not defending it. As a matter of fact, we were on the other side.
So nonetheless,
that was the finding in United We Stand, and that's the finding. That was the narrow case that the government tries to jump on here, which involved a different set of circumstances. This case is much more.
The difference comes down to one was Congress and one was the president.
Absolutely.
That's the difference in the end, right?
I'd say that's certainly the most significant difference. Absolutely.
What's the other difference?
Well, the court in the United Stand was very concerned about the confidential nature, that there was a specific confidential directive.
That's not what that case turned on, though, is it?
No, I would agree.
It turns on it being a congressional document, not subject to FOIA. This case, the government argues, should turn on this being a presidential document, not subject to FOIA.
Correct.
So that is the difference. I mean, we can talk a long, long time, but that's what we come back to in the end. Now, Judge Williams' question, which was part of what started this, I take it was, why shouldn't the president's, or was it just, it doesn't matter, somebody said, why shouldn't the president's authority to supervise the agencies play the same role as Congress's authority of oversight?
Because in this case, FOIA has already provided for and has a well-established procedure to protect the rights of the executive in that case in which there may be some confidential material which might come within the scope of the request. The process is already in existence. There's no reason.
Process, you're talking about the exemptions?
Correct.
Now, they are to protect the content of documents that are FOIA documents, but for the fact that they're exempt. That's not the argument of the government here. They're arguing that these are not FOIA documents in the first instance. That procedure doesn't cover this problem, does it?
If this court finds that these are not agency records, then that's correct, that it would come there. Our position is that these plainly are agency records. They fit well within the well-established test of records that has been set, what it is an agency record established by this court.
What test is it they fit well within?
It's the two-part test set forth by the Supreme Court in Tax Analysts of control, creation and control of records, and then the four-part test and setting forth what it is to control, for it, whether an agency controls a record, the four-part BRCA test, setting forth the four factors. The government's brief does not seriously contest that if that test, the two-part and then the control test is applied, that these are agency records. They do, at least as the district court found and the two previous district courts, at least three of the four factors as to control clearly show that these are agency records.
What are the three factors?
The three factors are that they have the ability to use and dispose of the records. They clearly use the records as part of their statutory function of protecting the White House complex. They clearly have the ability to dispose of the records. They signed an MOU that they're happy with, that which they purport to dispose of the records. They rely on the records, and which is the second factor of the three. They rely on the records in the performance of their duty, and the records are clearly integrated into their files, which is the final of the third. So as the district court found, at least three of the four show that these are records that are under agency control. And the FOIA sets forth a process that's very familiar to all agencies to protect any interests of the White House, which may or may not arise later on.
Can I ask you about that? So the court, quoting another court below, the district court, said, well, maybe none of these records will ever be disclosed. My guess is you think all these records will be disclosed. So let me ask you in the specific. We're talking about, again, the hypothetical, the president's daily calendar, who the president meets. And these records will disclose that because they disclose who, that is outside outsiders. That is, any outsider has to come into the White House through a waives request. When this case went back on remand to the district court, were you amicus in that case?
I believe we were, yes.
So Crew argued that none of the documents, that these are not protected at all because they do not disclose the communications between the president and that person, but only the identity. And the court agreed, leaving aside some hypothetical possibility that the court couldn't imagine, every visitor to the president would be disclosed. Now, isn't that your position, or do you think there is some visitor who would not be disclosed?
We have not taken a position on that.
Yeah, I'm asking you to take a position now because we want to know what the consequence will be. I mean, the district court softened the effect of the district court's opinion by saying, don't worry about it, there'll be exemptions. Even if it's an agency record, there'll be an exemption. I don't actually see what the exemption would be, at least on the arguments that you've made. It would come under presidential communications privilege, and so far the court hasn't said that identity as compared to content is protected. I assume that's your position, isn't it?
Again, we haven't gotten there yet. We haven't taken that position.
You haven't thought about what your position will be in the district court on the extent of the presidential communications privilege.
Obviously, we want to learn. We want the records to be disclosed. That's why we're here. Now, if there are records that are so sensitive, then the agency should assert the exemption, and that's what should be adjudicated.
But routinely, except for a record that you can't even hypothesize before me, the president's calendar will now be disclosed every day. Is that right?
I wouldn't say that is all correct. We're not asking for the president's calendar.
No, but you're effectively asking for it. Well, again, an example. The president, President Johnson liked to surprise the American people with respect to who his appointees would be. He wanted to keep it close for the last moment. Nonetheless, he had to meet with those prospective appointees in advance. The meeting would then disclose either who the president's appointees would be or who he was considering. Is there a presidential communications privilege that would allow the president to not produce to you at that point the four people he's considering for Secretary of the Treasury who he's just met?
Our position is not by any means that the executive does not, the president, the vice president does not have a need to conduct confidential activities. We're not suggesting that at all. I mean, clearly there are some circumstances.
The example I'm giving you, appointees, would that be a circumstance that comes within the presidential communications privilege? Just the identity. In other words, a waive record says, you know, I want to meet with the president of Citibank, the president of Morgan Stanley, a professor who doesn't like either Citibank or Morgan Stanley. Those are the three people I want to meet with. And the waives report lists those three people, and they all come in one after the another on a Monday morning. Would there be anything that would prevent disclosure of those names?
I would respond to that by saying that just because those people happen to appear does not indicate anything necessarily.
Right. That is the question. I think. I'm sorry.
Well, it's not exactly the question.
But that means that it would be disclosed. When you say that it wouldn't indicate anything, that means the president would not be able to meet with the people he wants to appoint without disclosing them to the world before he appoints them.
So that's the question.
That's right, isn't it?
At the White House, at least, he would not be able to meet with them without it being disclosed that they'd been at the White House. Now, it might be possible to structure this so that it wouldn't disclose they met with the president. I mean, it could be that they would all be listed under the chief of staff's name or somebody else at the White House, but they would at least have to disclose they were there, right?
That is the current way the system works, that is how the records are created. That is correct. Now, again,
it could be created in such a fashion as not to show the meeting with the president himself, rather only to show that they were there and that somebody vouched them in.
And certainly there are people of that sort that appear at the White House for any reason, for any variety of reasons on a routine basis. So would there be circumstances? There may be. We may get to that point. It's going to be in this case.
Can you hypothesize one?
I'm sorry?
Can you hypothesize one for me?
Well, the government has suggested that there might be areas within national security and other sensitive areas which may require confidentiality. We have no issue with that. Obviously, there are times.
Wait, just to be clear, since you're on the record here, you have no issue with merely the identity of a person being covered by the presidential communications privilege, if disclosure would have some effect on national security.
Again, it will be the government's burden to show that. Okay, I mean we agree, but are there likely to be something out there that, in the end, I mean, I think that's entirely possible. But again, it will be the government's burden to show that, and that's how the FOIA process works. Ultimately, is they have to meet their.
Can you hypothesize one for me? I just want to know whether the effect of this really will be complete disclosure. So just make one up where you think that the government would be able to satisfy its burden.
I think it's entirely possible that in some circumstances. That there could be a unique visitor that could be so sensitive that simply by the identity of that person that it would reveal that something was there. But that, again, it's a hypothetical. We don't know that. We may get to that point, but we're not there. And to suggest that this entire broad swath of records is somehow outside of FOIA. Because of that one possible scenario in the future, which is their burden to prove, is in our opinion unjustified.
If, for example, there were a small number of very important Israelis who showed up on a day at which there was an issue at large involving the atomic energy structure of some neighbor of Israel's, that might be something that would be disclosing a national security concern, might it not?
It might, but I suspect there are also delegations of Israelis going to the White House.
It may help you if you say yes.
But it's interesting that you resist even that one. That was the only hypothetical I could think of.
Even that one, it makes it pretty rough for you.
Well,
if that one's not one and you can't come up with one, then maybe the concern's realer than it would be otherwise.
Well, let me give you a different hypothetical then. Then I'll suggest, how about SEAL Team 6? If SEAL Team 6 showed up, that would reveal their identities. And up until now, with some minor exception, the Obama administration has suggested that their identities should not be revealed. And we're not suggesting that their identities should be. And we would think that would be at a time for a proper assertion of privilege. So yes.
Got one.
I just wonder, in your brief here, you somewhat disparaged the MOU, but I was wondering whether. In the district court, you raised any question about the section of the MOU, which is a recitation of background.
I'm not sure I clearly understand your question.
I'm looking at the joint appendix pages 13 and 14, which is a segment of the MOU headlined background. And I was wondering whether in the district court, You said that you disbelieved propositions asserted there, or that you had evidence that some of the propositions were inaccurate, or you wanted discovery to uh, go into the validity of those assertions?
We have not disputed the statements made by the government as to the functioning of the system itself. No, that is correct.
Okay, including as described in this segment, this one-page segment on background, which I think, as its title suggests, is intended as a description of the conduct preceding the reaching of the agreement.
I mean, I would have to concede we are here on summary judgment. I mean, we did.
We did not dispute that. We can't have summary judgment on this issue because we've got to dig into the true facts and circumstances that are claimed by the government to exist. In, among other things, the background section of the MOU. But I mean, it may be your answer you gave me earlier is broader when you said you perhaps you should repeat it so that I know exactly what it is you're saying.
We did not
contest the government's purportedly factual statements about the relationship between the White House and the Secret Service with respect to these documents.
We have not contested the Secret Service's recitation as to the nature of these records and how they are created.
And how they are handled as between how they historically have been handled as between White House and Secret Service. Is that correct?
We have not contested any facts at this point. Yes, that's correct.
I'm sure we're way beyond your allotted time, so we will, unless there are further questions. Thank you, counsel. I'm sure we also were beyond Mr. Stern's time. However, we'll give him back 2 minutes for rebuttal, should he wish it.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel.
Your Honor, I have very little to add to.
Good, then I have a question.
But as I was going to say, I'm certainly happy to answer questions.
I think Mr. Peterson makes a nice point on the question I asked you earlier, which is, what about the requests from components of the White House that are not FOIA exempt?
The Secret Service in this capacity is basically they are there because they are a gatekeeper for the president, the people who come in, they're within the sort of protective area. That's why they have to give.
Well, I understand.
Names.
I understand why.
But
why
we've
that's
all been there.
No, no, yeah.
About the components that are not FOIA exempt.
Right.
Why is a request by for access to the Secret Service by a component that is not FOIA exempt? Why should that waive record be?
Well, Your Honor, there's the request can, of course, for like visitors, calendars, anything else can be made to any FOIA entity within the White House.
But who it's made by at this point, though?
Excuse me, Your Honor.
Who it's made by at this point? If the request is made by,
yes.
Not exempt.
Let's say an intern in the Office of Technology Assessment, or whatever it's mm-hmm. called now, which where the courts already held is not FOIA exempt, mm-hmm. or the Council of there's another one that we've already held.
The environmental.
Yeah, exactly.
Quality.
Exactly, and they make a request to the Secret Service. Please admit, a representative of Exxon and a representative of an organization that hates Exxon. Please admit both of those.
Your Honor, sort of, I think. If one imagines that the president was able to, I'm sorry, Your Honor, if one imagines that the president was able to take the gatekeeper function and vest it in the White House usher, who's not a FOIA agency, you would still, to get into the grounds, even though you might be going to see somebody else who was not actually in the White House, you would give your name just for purposes of clearance to the usher. And what the usher had, even though it wasn't reflecting anything about what was happening in the White House, those would not be agency records. Now, of course,
that was a conclusion. That would conclude.
So would these not be agency?
No, they would. I mean, those, if a request to the usher, it would not matter who the information was about, because the usher is not a FOIA agency. So, but you can present your request to OMB, Council of Economic Environmental Quality. There's no information that is going to be shielded as a result of this. You've got all the rights, of course, that you have to like ask any of those agencies for they may have exemptions, but you can ask them for all their desk calendars, everybody who visited anywhere.
Imagine again that the only way we can do this is through a neat hypothetical. So here's the neat hypothetical, all right? So the Council on Economic Equality asks the Secret Service, puts in a waives request to admit Mr. X, okay? There's now a waive record that says a non-FOIA exempt agency, namely the CEQ, has requested access. Why shouldn't that document be disclosed?
Well, because what we have in this context is the Secret Service just acting as the president's gatekeeper.
Well, here he's acting as the CEQ's gatekeeper.
Well, no, they really, I think that's the important point. They really aren't. And again, the bottom line is not to shield anything about those agencies. That's why I brought up the usher example. If the president, the only reason this is all happening, if it was only OMB in there, there was no interest in screening, Secret Service has no interest in screening visitors to OMB. They're screening people who come on.
Screening people because they're coming on the White House complex. If the request comes from CEQ, would in the real world the usher really be in that, or does it go to Secret Service?
No, my point would be like if...
You put the usher in there.
No, right? That's right, Your Honor.
The hypothetical.
No,
CEQ makes a request, it goes to Secret Service, a wave's created. Why is that wave not subject to FOIA?
Because the reason that the Secret Service is there is to protect the president. The president can't internalize that function.
Why does this matter? I understand the argument about why the president shouldn't have to rearrange, go through some surreptitious means in order to have his daily schedule. But why does this what argument is there about interference with the president, separation of powers interference with the president, if visitors to the CEQ are disclosed?
Your Honor, we aren't asserting that there's a separation of powers problem about it, nor are we saying that you can't get the information. It's just the way that the protective function is structured.
In what way would it interfere with the protective function for a, look, let me ask it again. Do you agree that the daily calendar of the head of CEQ is FOIA-able, subject to whatever exemptions?
That's correct.
So we know that that person has to get into the White House complex somehow. In what way is disclosing the WAVE record, which discloses the same thing, would it interfere with protection of the president? There's nothing in any affidavit that suggests that would interfere with the protection of the president.
I totally understand Your Honor's point, and again, you're absolutely right. We're not trying to assert that would interfere with the president. We don't think that what we're proposing is going to shield any information either. We do think that analytically it makes sense to regard these, that all the WAVES records, because of the reason they're created and the assertions of control, it does make sense to look at them, as being presidential records.
So I was trying to divide your arguments into two conceptual halves. One conceptual half is based on the fact that this would effectively require a non-FOIA agency to disclose under FOIA. The other argument is your broader argument about control, which has problems with respect to how far it would reach. This argument you're now making only uses your broader argument about control, doesn't it?
Your Honor, the crucial part is obviously the sort of part that goes to the non-FOIA agencies. Our own point is that the fact that OMB is in the White House grounds doesn't mean that the appropriate means for getting that information is to make a request to the Secret Service. There, it really is to make a request to OMB, because, you know, in the end, it's also still going to be OMB that the Secret Service isn't holding on to these documents, to the records. They're providing them to the White House. To the extent you want to get information about OMB, and OMB desk calendars, the people who are going to have to review that and assert the privileges are going to be at OMB.
Pull together your argument in a slightly different way. With respect to these requests to the Secret Service from non-exempt entities within the Office of the President, all the information that the requester seek is available to them, and I take it your burden argument pops up again here, does it not? Because here there's a burden, there would be a burden imposed on the Secret Service of sorting out all this in order to give the requester something which he could get very easily without that burden
That's correct. In essence, it's sort of requiring the sort of a restructuring of the way that the Secret Service records its material that's irrelevant to the function that is performing. And also, if people come into the White House grounds, regardless of where they may be first going to OMB, that doesn't mean that they're staying in OMB. They can move to another part.
Would that be disclosed by anything we're talking about here?
Well,
that's irrelevant, isn't it?
Yeah. But, Your Honor, again, our point is not the key point of the argument is the one that, you know, the court has identified. This part of the argument is really just goes to the way that the Secret Service has had to structure operations at the White House complex.
The question of non-exempt entities, Department of Secret Service, raised at all before the district court?
I don't know. I really don't know. I don't recall it being in the opinion, and it's.
But we're hearing this on summary judgment, right?
That's right.
So our review is de novo, right?
That's certainly true. No, I was only saying that I don't really know whether it was ever raised. I just recall not seeing it in the opinion, and of course, no one has ever suggested I realize this isn't dispositive of anything, but no one's ever suggested that what people want in this or any of its predecessor cases are records of people who went to see the Council on Environmental Quality.
It could potentially make a difference in the breadth of the order or judgment.
No, that's correct, Your Honor. And again, I think, you know, want to emphasize the part that we regard as most important, but we do think that it's also correct that the Secret Service, the way this is set up, should be understood to make all of them presidential records. But again, making absolutely clear that we do not in any way think that should impair the ability of requesters to get information from agencies.
That's the case. It seems like you're making an argument that you could then make as a burden argument. That is, if you could say the requester can get the same information by going directly to CEQ, then the district court would be able to address whether it's also worth making the Secret Service produce the same information in a different way, but that's not before us now.
No, but that's also not our argument on appeal.
I thought you were making an argument that somebody is going to have, Secret Service can't make these judgments.
No, that's,
somebody else is going to
have. No, our point is that the fact that recognizing that these are agency records in no way impairs the purpose of FOIA, of allowing a FOIA requester to learn what agencies are doing or are up to, because that function, nothing we're suggesting would in any way impair their ability to do that. So it's not a burden argument as we're presenting it here.
No. That means there's not a separation of powers concern at all. This issue would have to rest on our accepting your control argument, right?
Well, yes, except for the fact that the separation of powers comes in because we are talking about a service that records that are being created only because the Secret Service is there to protect the president.
Perhaps there's such a thing as an ignorant question. This may be one. What separation of powers between whom and whom? I mean, in the congressional instance, you're talking about a separation of powers between the congressional branch and the executive. Both of these are within executive branch. Is this really a separation of powers?
Well, I think that there is, and that's what Armstrong recognized when it said that Congress was,
so
quote,
Congress's
keenly
power to enact a FOIA.
Right, and I think and that's why they did exempt the president and his staff sole function.
So it does go all the way to saying, if we hold with you, that Congress did not have the power to enact a FOIA that would cause the release of these documents.
No, we're not arguing what Congress, we think that constitutional concerns, like if necessary, could inform the court's opinion. Our point is simply that if Congress
There is a separation of powers,
yes, there is a power,
that's the one there is that is there, right?
Yes, we think that's right. It's a Congress and the president enforcing the president to the unacceptable choice.
So you're
choice.
Not really saying there's a separation of powers argument. You're saying there's a constitutional avoidance problem.
We have made this as a constitutional avoidance argument. That's correct.
Thank you, counsel. Unless my colleagues have further questions, the case will be submitted, and then we will take a brief recess.